Welcome to the Fabric Podcast. As we come into the winter and start looking toward the end of the year and the holidays under the cloud of this global pandemic, it can feel heavy, like something is dying. Still, death seems to have some interesting overlap with birth. What if this moment could be a signal that something new is being born?
We've been talking about a simple idea all month as we approach Christmas, a Christmas which is coming at one of the most difficult shared times worldwide we've had in several generations. This simple idea is that we can look at all this mess, this pain and uncertainty that exists around and within us, and conclude that everything is falling apart or that something new is being born. They're both hard, they're painful and messy, but they have very different outcomes. And whether it is one of those or the other is not a matter of chance. Which will it be? Something being born or everything falling apart? No, it's a matter of choice. We decide whether we will live with the rubble or whether we will pick up the pieces and create the future with one another. Now, that process of something new being born has a couple of distinct steps. First, there is the conceiving of what will be. Whether you were searching and hoping for it or were completely caught off guard, it doesn't matter. It has begun. But it certainly isn't here among us yet. We talked about that the first week. Then there is a stage of carrying this new thing before it is fully formed, before it is ready for the world, invisible in some ways, but increasingly uncomfortable, awkward, and obvious in others. So little you can do, but you can already see the impact it is going to have on you and the responsibility that you are going to have for it. Last week, we talked about the next part of the process, the birth itself. It is only a moment in time, but it feels like dying, and in fact, something is. Joy, pain, hopes, loss, they all come together, whether what was born was your own child, the social movement birthed when George Floyd was murdered, or some dream you've worked long and hard to be part of your life. Today, we're talking about what's next. The new thing born now exists, and you have the task that you can never be truly ready for, raising it up, and the inevitable letting go as it grows. I must say, my wife Chris's and my raising of our four children is a part of our lives that I know we are the most proud of, and probably the part that we can take the least credit for, because we did it, but we were never in control. Raising them has brought us more joy than anything else in our lives and was easily the hardest things that we have ever done. Now there's a lot more than children that we birth and raise up in our lives, and this raising up isn't only something we do individually. We're raising a nation together right now, together as a society. And this is happening as we approach a Christmas unlike any we have ever known. But Christmas is always about the birth of Jesus. And I think that when we peel away all the sentimentality of the season and look at what it meant that earth was broken open so something new could be born and live here, and then that new thing landed in Mary and Joseph's laps to be raised, and in reality is now in our laps to be raised, it all sounds like Christmas is describing what is happening today more than it is a reminiscence of something that happened thousands of years ago. To help me understand all this and to talk to you about it, I'm particularly pleased to have three amazing people with me today. I want to welcome Verlin Hemman, lead for clinical pastoral education at North Memorial Health here in the Twin Cities, as well as part-time pastor of spiritual care at Peace Church in Eagan, not to mention a husband, father, grandfather, and Harley rider. And then we also have Lindsay Waltz, founder of the recently closed Courageous Hearts, a nonprofit art studio illuminating youth as leaders. Now she's turned resilience coach and consultant. You can find her at lindsaywaltz.com. And Carl Alfers, who has been in the digital side of major healthcare companies from product development to CEO, raising up new companies and leaders along the way. He's also a husband and father and all-around good guy. Verlin's reflection on this raising up business helped us all think more deeply about the topic. We'll start there. Verlin, I know you, in your long history, has spent a lot of time raising a lot of different kinds of things, and I know it's an area that you think about a lot as well. So when I talk about this raising part of something new being born, right, into our world, what comes to mind for you?
Well, the first thing that came to mind for me was around what we often think about in clinical pastoral education, that people to become professional in the work that they do go through four different stages. They start out unconscious, incompetent. And then after their first call on their first patient, they become conscious of their incompetence. And that's where
am I supposed to locate myself? Like, yeah.
That would be up to you, Greg.
Okay.
So then when you get conscious and competent, immediately you have to deal with the feelings of shame and anxiety. And that's one of the most difficult places. I don't think this is only true for chaplaincy. I think this is true in any profession or even in parenting. You know, a kid doesn't know what they don't know until they find out that they don't know something. So then you have to deal with their feelings of shame and guilt and what have you. So to move on, then you move to conscious competent, which means that you know what you're doing and why you're doing it, and you start to feel pretty good about it until there comes a point, and some people say it takes 10,000 hours, where you become unconscious competent. But you don't have to think about every response you make. You just sort of live it and do it and act it. Now, the danger there is that you stay there because in order to continue to develop and to grow, you need to step back into the conscious, competent phase every once in a while and examine what you're doing. You know, I've been doing this for 10 years. Is that still the most effective way to do it? Or is there another way to do it? So I think those four categories have been very, very helpful to try to walk with people as they mature, as they raise up, to recognize, you know, do they know what they don't know? And I might know it, so how do I help them see what they don't see? How do I help them hear what they aren't hearing? And that's my job then, to create a very non-shaming atmosphere, a very loving, accepting atmosphere, so that they can face themselves. Mm-hmm.
To know that that is all a natural process. Like, you aren't going to get to unconscious competence without having gone through your consciously realizing you don't know what you're doing. Yeah,
that's exactly right. My very first night on call when I was doing clinical pastoral education, and this was a long time ago, back in the 70s. My first night on call, I'm 27 years old. I've just had my first child. He's a month old. And a baby coded three different times in that night and then died. The mom was 16 and the dad was 15. And I walked into the room and the doctor handed that baby to us. And I had absolutely nothing to say. I wept with them because all I could think about was my own child. But I could see the pain on them and I didn't know what to do or say. And you talk about becoming conscious of your incompetence in a hurry. That was mine, and that's what I think really drove me deeper into this whole field of clinical pastoral education. I didn't want to feel that incompetent ever again.
Yeah, that's really, really hard. Did that make you, though, just get gun-shy? Like, were you afraid to go into those places because the stakes seemed too high? And
Yeah, I was afraid. The beauty of the program and what I love about the work that I do is that when you have an experience like that, you come back to a group of peers with a supervisor or an educator and you declare your incompetence. And the group, the small group, a group of four or five, are there with you in such a way that you can feel exposed, but also then you use their feedback to say, the next time I'm in this situation, I'm going to try this or do that. I think that is such a critical piece of what we're talking about here. It's true for parents. It's true for any organization. If you don't have a peer group that you can reflect on your process with, you're standing there alone. And to me, that's frightening and leads to all kinds of dangerous potentials. So I love that. And I think that's why church can be so significant for people. It can create those peer groups, if you will, where you can wonder about your life. This is what I'm thinking or feeling. This is how I'm parenting right now. How do you guys think about this? How do you guys see it? That's powerful stuff.
I have to break in here because Verlin just expressed something that we don't hear often enough. When you hear church, you may say yay or nay, I don't know, but For most people, church is not what Verlin was just talking about, a place to explore who we are, what we're thinking and feeling, and to do that together. Instead, church is typically seen as a place to fit in, to conform our behaviors and beliefs in order to belong, to learn what it means to be our kind of person and not that kind of person. But as Fabric, we're trying to live into the idea of what Verlin is talking about. And I hope this podcast gives you a bit of that experience. Okay, back to the conversation. Lindsay, as Verlin was speaking there, I saw you nodding your head a lot. How does this relate to some of your work or your thoughts?
Oh, so many different places.
Well, pick one.
Well, so one of the things I was thinking about in just those four stages is the relationship with learning and being a human and how we, I think that's just like a, that's like the process of life, right? Like we think we have it figured out and then turns out we don't in any situation in our lives. And then we deal with the like hard feelings of not having it figured out. And then we have to figure out how to figure it out. and then we think we've got it. And then life shows us that we don't in some new way. And then we have to start all over again. You know, I've been a youth worker. I always say I'm a youth worker by vocation. It's vocation is a calling, right? It's something that you do, mm-hmm. whether or not it's your label in whatever way. I think one of the ways that it has been such a life-giving work for me is because young people have the gift of asking why. And as a youth worker, I try really hard to live into that why, right? If I can't answer that question, if I can't give a good response as to why the world is the way it is in some way, shape, or form, then I have to reevaluate my own framework and my own what I know, right?
Right. And if I can't say why it should be this way, I shouldn't be enforcing that it is that way.
Absolutely. And like, you know, in kids' worlds, it's rules of all different shapes and sizes and the structures of school or the, you know, like there's all kinds of stuff. And then there's all the big questions too. Like, why aren't people solving global warming? Right? Like, why is this a problem? Like, why is this not something that everyone is taking seriously? And all of those questions deserve real responses and real answers. And I'm really passionate about that. And then as I've grown up, as I've tried to live into being an adult, which I think I've actually just this morning was thinking, you know, like I feel like a lot of adults are just performing adulthood. Nobody actually knows what that means, except that we have this construct of what you're supposed to be as an adult. And usually what you're supposed to be is you're supposed to know all the things and you're supposed to have the answers and you're supposed to be steady and not emotional, like you're not supposed to have tantrums and you're not like all these things.
Yeah, I think you're right, Lindsay. As a young person looking at getting raised up and, you know, growing up, and you want to become like one of those grown-ups, you think you are in control, that you've got to, you know, figure it out. And we all know that that doesn't actually happen. But because we have that illusion, when we do become an adult, because you have no choice by this time, you're on your own more or less. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things we do is we convince ourselves that we did figure it out. We did get to that unconscious competence, even though, it's really just unconscious, fording through, right? The river.
Like certain things we get really good at, right? Like we get good at paying, we figure out how to pay the bills on time, or we, you know, like some of these really concrete responsibilities that we need to do. But then we almost can get kind of unconsciously stuck in that. Yeah. Is what life is, right? Is paying the bills and making sure you have a job to pay the bills. And if you're stuck there, that's not a very meaningful
existence. Keep your own emotional baggage and your questions and your doubts about the world stuffed away so they don't challenge all that.
Yeah.
So Carl, you say that you can relate to these stages of development, professional development, which is that's us getting raised up, right, Verlin?
Yeah, it is. And I think we have to You know, one of my favorite phrases is, it's all about you and it's not at all about you. And so you have to focus on yourself so that you can focus on other people.
All right. So that's interesting, because my immediate thing was like, I'm thinking about raising up other things. But I need to be thinking about me being raised up. Although the little tweak I'm going to have with that, Verlin, is that a lot of what I'm thinking about raising up aren't people at all. Like, we're raising up social movements right now.
Yeah.
And those are the babies we're having. Mm-hmm. And right now, some of them are already born, I think, in the manger. I think a lot of them are still in utero, or maybe even they're only just being conceived. They're not even don't quite even exist yet. So I don't want to only talk about, you know, societal sort of things like this. I want to talk about us as people, raising up the leaders around us, the children around us, raising up ourselves. But Carl, as you were hearing Verlin, you were saying, yeah, I can relate to this.
Yeah.
Tell me, what are you thinking?
This framework that you have around conceiving, carrying, birthing, and then raising up / letting go is actually, if I think about it, for me personally, represents sort of the areas that I really like to focus as a leader, and then where I've recently learned how to let go of a company. And if you would have given me this like 11 months ago, Greg, it would have been super helpful, by the way. I'll give you the real story there. I was part of a company, you know, when we started out, we were 60 employees, and over the course of 7 years, we grew it to 1500 employees with offices all across the country. And I went from being chief product officer to being CEO. And what I learned is that once it gets to the point of raised up, that is actually the point where I need to let go of the company. Because at that point, that's not my superpower anymore, which is just to operate and maximize what comes out of that company. And I had going through that experience is what then allowed me to learn, which has led to me to where I am now, which is I'm CEO of a company that is in very much the conceiving stage. We are 5 employees and raising venture capital and all of that, and really focused on getting our mission right at this point. That's what I love to do. That's where my passion comes in. Back to Verlin's point, like I had to realize that I could go through that process and I could probably learn that how to operate and just operate at large scale, but my passion wasn't there. And so that's when I knew I had to let go, and because I had an amazing team and they had a great organization around it, and that was going to be the best thing for that company.
Carl learned that through years of discovery, and I'm sure no little agonizing and heartache. What is it like when something you are responsible for grows and changes? It starts becoming something that you're not sure of any longer. This growing up stuff is hard for everyone. There's little in the Bible about Jesus growing up. He mostly goes from being a baby to starting his public career at age 30, which was at least middle-aged in those days. But we do get a few hints. Mary, as she learns who this child is that she bore, holds it in her heart and ponders it, the Bible says. That sounds a lot like mystified and troubled. And then there's the one and only story of Jesus growing up. When his parents took him to Jerusalem when he was 12 for the Passover, he reportedly stayed behind when everyone else had left, giving his parents no small amount of distress, dazzling the teachers at the temple and making a smart-aleck remark when asked why he hadn't come along with everyone. The truth is that the new doesn't fit easily into the mold of what is. New wine bursts old wineskins, and that causes anxiety. Anxiety that we need to figure out what to do with if we're going to raise others or be raised ourselves. Let's go back to the conversation.
I am reminded of a phrase that comes out of family systems theory, and that the phrase is to be a non-anxious presence. I think if there's anything that I've tried to work on in my adult life is how do I stay non-anxious? Because there's so much that triggers anxiety. And that happens individually and it happens corporately. You can just feel it in an organization when anxiety is up. And if you're a leader or if you're a parent or whatever, figuring out how to get yourself non-anxious seems to be a really important piece of what we do.
sometimes the hardest things to say are the most loving things to say. And I don't think that we've had very many models of that publicly. Like, I think earlier I was thinking about representation. You know, we talk about that as it relates to race and culture a lot, but even just like ways of being in the world as like a source of representation that like, you know, so as a, I'm a survivor of the bridge collapse, and I have had to be, I haven't had to be on shows, but I've been on a few shows where they spend 49 to 55 minutes of the 1 hour show talking about the disaster and the moment after it happened and like all of the shock and awe of it. And then the last 5 minutes are all of us as survivors smiling and like going about our day as if the in-between was irrelevant to us smiling, right? And I, the first time I saw that particular show, I was so devastated because I felt like, oh my God, people are going to continue to believe that some people, like that there's just some people who walk away from something like that smiling, right? Like that's somehow inherent in some people. And if it's not happening for me to go through this hard thing easily, that I'm just like defective or something like that. And the reality is that like I had 6 years of devastating, non-smiling day. And I think about how do we as a culture start to tell the real true story of all the messiness in our lives, whether it's like the tension of a conversation that has lots of different sides, and how do we find a resolution within all of those varying perspectives, or like how do we heal from hard things and do so in a way, like especially when that's not a really public thing, right? But how do we create space for those stories to be held and told, right?
It's another big piece of the CPE process is we begin by telling our life story. Mm. And I, when we do that, I always start by telling mine first because I have some pretty significant trauma in my life. And by me being vulnerable and sharing it, it lets others know that it's safe to do that, first of all. And secondly, that healing can start happening as you tell the story. It's your story has to really become your own story. You have to claim it and own it. And then find out that the more I externalize it, the less control it seems to have on me. That's hard work, but it's so necessary.
Yeah. And that's the opposite. Sometimes we don't think we're helping people by asking them or like by listening to their hard story or creating space for their hard story. We think that somehow that's harmful.
Exactly.
And the reality is it's like one of the most powerful, meaningful things.
Yeah.
I'm hearing a theme behind what all three of you are saying that has a lot to do with something that I care a lot about, and that's failure. I care about it because I spend so much time doing it. No, I really think failure is a word we need in our vocabulary, but it's really a miscue. And what it really is the learning process. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't need a learning process if the first time we tried to learn something, we learned it and we had it. But that isn't how learning goes. Learning is cumulative. It has to be cumulative. And that means a lot of what we're trying in order to know what we need to learn next doesn't work. And that gets labeled as failure and becomes a stop sign for people. But Verlin, your process that you're talking about, going from unconscious incompetence to unconscious competence, is a way of understanding how failure has got to be there. I mean, I'm going to have to go through these stages and I'm going to have experiences because that's the only thing that will continue to propel me to the next level of this. And then you're saying how this is circular too, because my tendency is once I am there to be unconsciously comfortable, mm-hmm. to have found like, oh, suddenly I got to the top of the plateau and this is where you're supposed to be. Well, whether it is or it isn't, either you'll get forgetful or times will change or the situation will change and, you know, it will erode. It's like a bank account with service charges. You know, you can have it as full as you want. And over time, it will gradually get in the red again. As a society, we're not good at failure. We want to be there. Like, okay, we had this child. we realize we need to do some sort of police reform. We realize we got racial issues. We realize whatever the list might be. Now let's fix that. And we're real uncomfortable with this period of time where we develop competence around it. My assumption is it's really hard to do as an individual. As a society, reaching a competence is much, much harder. Mm-hmm. Because you have a lot more people trying to work it out. And our discomfort with raising up this thing that has been birthed among us and having it, we want it to be fully functional. We want it to be a competent adult now. And it's this toddler that trips over his toys that he left on the floor, or the preteen who, I don't know, it's been so long since I was a preteen, I don't remember what they do. Carl, you're the expert on that one right now. I really do believe our fear of failure and of our unwillingness to continue learning or to be in this uncomfortable place is one of our problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Greg, I agree with that. And I actually, like, Bruin, I was just thinking, and Greg, as you were speaking about the comment you made around being anxious and anxiety, and that being the crux of why we often have a hard time, Greg, doing exactly what you just described. Because I think we do, like, we get caught up, all of us, right? And the best thing we can do is to own it. We get caught up in this anxiety to have it done, to have it perfect. And when we let that win, we just jump to the end conclusion. And it's whatever you're creating, whatever you're building is never as good as if you were to push that anxiety to a side and let yourself and your team and your organization or whatever it may be that is building it actually take the time to get there. I really think that's a powerful insight that Verlin just had, and actually one that I'm going to take out of this, because I do think that anxiety is sometimes is what's actually stopping us from going through the process.
That idea of going through the process is huge, because no matter whether the new thing born is your child or a movement you help birth or a business, raising it up is a shift from being totally dependent on you and you, therefore, totally responsible for it. And then going from there to letting go and letting the new person, movement, business, whatever, determine its own direction and have its own life beyond you. And that's hard. So I had a very close friend a couple decades ago who was kind of an inventor sort of guy. And he was always creating products and trying to get them to market and stuff like that. And he finally had one that was really going well. And he's just poured everything, including a second mortgage, into this to try to make it happen, and was working with manufacturers and finally had deals with some chain to start carrying this product for us and was bringing people. I mean, it was like a one person operation for years and years, and he gradually hired more people. And he had a person who was doing more of an executive role with him at this point. And they all sat him down at one time and said, we need you to step out. The only thing that's keeping us from being successful with this product is you. Mm-hmm. Is that you did everything you could for it. And at this point, you are not the person to take it to the next level. That was one of the hardest things in his life they ever had. And frankly, he couldn't let go. I think about that in terms of these movements we have going on in society of this raising something up, and then you got to let go. And so where I'm going with all that is, as we're four white-bodied people here talking about this and recognizing that racial justice is one of the biggest issues around us, my instinct as a white-bodied person is to raise this up and be in charge of it, because that's what we do. And I'm wondering what raising up this issue of racial equity and letting go of it looks like. And I'm conscious of it all the time, but the main thing I'm conscious of it is that I'm consciously incompetent, Verlin, of doing that.
Yeah, I resonate with that big time, Greg. Thank you for your honesty about that. The word that's been circulating in my mind here is control. I think the more other people get involved with something, the less control I have as an individual. Mm-hmm. And I think this is true with the painful story you told of your friend and his invention. he lost control. He couldn't stand to lose control of the project.
It's his baby.
Yeah. And that's true for my, I remember dropping my son off at college he was our oldest, and he went to NDSU, and my wife and I drove to Fergus Falls before we could speak, because it was such a painful, joyful time of releasing him, but realizing he was going to fly far beyond and we were no longer in control of any of that. And I think that's true of what we're talking about with the racial justice issue. We as white people cannot be in control of this, but we still want to, we want to declare ourselves competent in dealing with it. And we're not the ones who get to declare that. I don't think that's our job or our right. We've been declaring too much for too long. Mm-hmm. And so owning the fact that we have to let go is hard, but so necessary.
I've resonated with everything that's been said so far. One of the things that I thought about in the conscious letting go, there's a consciousness that can happen in letting go, right? If you recognize the need to do it, right? This idea of parenting has been a metaphor I've used for a really long time with my nonprofit. I realized early on when I was the mom doing all the things, even though I'm not really a mom, I can only imagine based on all the stories I've heard, right? having to hold the baby and wash the hair and do the dishes, whatever, right? You're doing all the things. And I was really aware at one point, that's what I am right now to this organization. And that ends at some point. And it's kind of up to me when that ends. There are some parents who continue to do that until someone graduates from high school or moves to college or returns home after college. If the economy's not right, right? And I had to make a conscious decision that okay, they're two now and they actually really do need me to do all of these things, right? But they're going to be five soon, and that, metaphorically, and I'm going to need to send it off to college or to not to college. You don't send kids usually to college at five, but to kindergarten. And and actually kindergarten is one of those first really truly letting go points. And one of the things that I had to think about was, what do I want to make sure is here before, and you think about the values that you instill in your little person or your little organization or your little business, the little things that you want to make sure are so deep in them that the world can't get at it, right? And I think about that as it relates to the movement, right? And the movement issues we're talking about is, what are the things that are so deeply important to the phrase defund the police, right? A lot of conversation lately about that term, right? The president mm-hmm. himself said that wasn't a good use of terms. And other people have said, but we're talking about it. We're actually having conversations we would never be having if this term, this group of words wasn't causing some of this upheaval in us. And I think as a white person, it's really important to me to pay very close attention to the values and the intentions behind those words, and to make sure I really understand what Black folks mean when they say defund the police, right? And that I'm not then turning it into something that makes me feel more comfortable. And if I am uncomfortable with an aspect of it or a piece of it, that's a call to me to come into conversation with other people and to continue to have those conversations, to ask questions, right? And that's where that imagination and the messiness shows up, is that having a collaborative, well, what about this? And, how does that work? How can we, what could the solution be to this problem I'm having with this idea right now?
To deal with that way though, Lindsay, you're really asking a lot of people to come to the table with their mature self and to stay at the table.
I know. And that's why I'm trying to do more work with young people, the young people inside adults. So we can deal with all that stuff that's been lingering around in us, because we never really figured out how to be an adult, because we just are performing it, right?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, Lindsay, I think it's, this is where I love this, Greg, this framework around, you know, these phases, because I do think on this topic, we are really in the conceiving phase, and it's really important that we do listen, because I think there's unbelievable energy around reforming the police right now that can really be harnessed. And I'll just tell you like a real example here, you know, in our neighborhood, we've got a group trying to work with the city council around like a pragmatic path forward. And the example that I tell you, I definitely would never have happened in the past, but happened last weekend. There's a group, Northside group, that was meeting with some city council members last Sunday. And we actually got our talking points from them, because it's a really tricky balance at the moment, right? Because we're down, you know, 15-20% on the police force already because of the 100 plus people that are out on PTSD. So it's a really tricky balance right now around how to keep momentum around reform and keep things viable. And so that Northside group has been really vocal and on point. We followed their lead. We didn't use our own talking points. And so I think that's an example to your point around being consciously incompetent about this. It's not our job, right? Our job is to like lean in and actually to stay involved, Lindsay. Like that is spot on.
My organization, Courageous Hearts, if I haven't named it yet, but I ran it with young people, high schoolers, for 8 years, right? Like I had a youth advisory board, and every idea that was a new idea went to them before it went into the world. So like I would come with an idea and I would think it was the best idea, because obviously, right?
Like, you came up with it.
And I'd come to them with the idea. At the end of the meeting, the idea would be so much better than I could have ever conceived of. And it's because I had the openness and the willingness to hear from them and to get their input on what I was thinking about. And it was always made better. I'm a firm believer in how collaboration makes everything better. And I think when we hold too tightly to our idea, we're doing everyone a disservice, including ourselves.
So Lindsay, a little truth telling for me is I love what you're saying, and I try to practice the same thing, but that willingness and openness to rethinking it and improving it, I often have that. I often don't have that. So what I have tried to do is create processes that I have to do it. Because I often have, I do love my idea. I'm either too tired or too in love with it, or who knows what, too grumpy, doesn't matter, to really be willing to unthink it or rethink it. But I've created a process that I have, that I've held myself accountable to. And I go there and I inevitably find what you did find, that they do help it. And I'm more excited. I'm more energized. I think it's a better product now, and I'm really glad I did it. But if I had left it up to my own willingness, my emotional state at that time, I very likely wouldn't have done it. And this is where we do have to hold each other accountable. You know, Verlin, you're talking about having these mentors, having these people that you are accountable to in a hopefully a friendly, mutual engagement with each other. Well, we do this for each other to support each other, not to call each other out, but we're helping each other grow. Exactly. It's just so valuable. I don't have the personal will or strength to always be trying to improve myself. I just don't. And I don't think I'm expected to. I think we were made to do this in community. So what I'm hearing from these 4 weeks is, in conceiving and caring and birthing and raising up, it's messy and it's hard work. Thanks. way to go. All right. I'm ready for that. I guess I want some good news. Just in a phrase, where's the good news in this raising up challenge? It's a challenge. Where is the good news in this? What are the positive, the hopeful, the stuff that we know we can do, things that come to mind? You've said them in a lot of ways already, but what are they? Verlin, where's the good news in this raising up challenge we've got?
Well, the first thing I think about is that in doing this hard work, you get surprised by joy. You don't even realize how good it feels once you've done the work, or some of the work. There's release, there's a sense of freedom, there's a sense of just happiness to be known. And so I think we all long to be known and to be in deeper relationship. And that's what happens when you do that hard work. So, and it doesn't, you're not called to it, you want to resist it. But when you go in and do it, you get surprised by joy.
Lindsay, where's the good news in all this stuff?
I have to piggyback on what Verlin was saying. I think in my life, pain and joy are like two sides of the same coin. And if you are willing to experience pain, you're also like so much more open to joy. And I think that's aliveness to me. And I've been on a crusade to live fully into my life since I almost lost it. And so that means embracing all of it, just being with all of it. And the more open you are to the hard stuff, the more open you are to the happy.
Carl?
Yeah, I actually, when I think about this, I and maybe this is, I'm a masochist this way, but I actually view the process and the pain as a wonderful thing, because the end product that we get from it is so much greater when we go through it. And so I think it's actually all really, like, frankly, a beautiful thing if you're willing to go through it, because where you get to at the end is just a very different place than if you took the shortcuts and you didn't go through it. So that's my perspective on it.
Hey, thank you, you guys. I had a lot of fun. I would love to get you together again and pick your brains on another topic sometime.
Absolutely.
Be great.
Carolyn and Lindsay, thank you. That was really enjoyable. I learned a lot, actually. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Someday soon, hopefully, we'll be able to get together in person to do this over a cup of coffee, right?
That would be nice. That would be nice.
And thank you for listening. And even more so for entertaining the thoughts and imaginations that went through your head, heart, and body about all of this growing up that's going on within you, no matter what your age is. And also for your part in helping others travel that road of healthy interdependence as you raise them up and let them go. So may this holy season help you celebrate the gift of togetherness, even if you can't have it this year. And may it also help you celebrate the unique gifts of other people, gifts that are unlike anything you have or would ever expect or would have ever thought you wanted. And remember, it may not always look this way, and it may be a long time coming, and many others may never see it, but something new is being born. Merry Christmas.
It's worth keeping this conversation going. Share this podcast with a friend and find discussion resources at fabricmpls.com. You can also go to our contact page or reach out on social media to share your feedback and experiences, because Fabric isn't an organization sharing novel ideas. It's a community of people becoming more deeply woven. Thanks for being part of it.